It was a recurring theme during the Obama presidency. Late every November, we would hear of another episode in the War on Christmas. Far from a new phenomenon, the wars on Christmas have been a part of the United States since well before its founding. This week, some lesser known of these battles and what they can tell us about the supposed war of today. I'm Nate Stripp, and this is Context, Please.
The Yuletide season is almost upon us, and the anti-Christmas crowd is already on the rampage, pillaging and plundering our long-cherished holiday tradition.
For all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
Over the years, we've taken on the role of protecting the federal holiday of Christmas. As you know, there are some Americans who are offended by any reference to Jesus Christ. And that's what the USA celebrates on December 25th, the birth of the baby Jesus.
You know, we're getting near that beautiful Christmas season that people don't talk about anymore. They don't use the word Christmas because it's not politically correct. You go to department stores and they'll say Happy New Year and they'll say other things and it'll be red. They'll have it painted, but they don't say, well, guess what? We're saying Merry Christmas again.
Today, most pundits who discuss the war on Christmas view it largely in semantic terms. In short, an overly aggressive, too politically correct minority who is determined to prevent the words Merry Christmas from ever again entering the public square. The celebration of Christmas, or lack thereof, has been a source of conflict previously in more dramatic and sometimes violent ways. In the early days of the Republic, it was not recognized as a significant holiday or even a notable day of rest in many places. Congress did not declare a formal recess for the holiday until 1857, and on two occasions, 1797 and 1802, members of Congress even met on the floor. Not until 1870 was Christmas, along with New Year's Day, Independence Day, and Thanksgiving, designated as a federal holiday. These initial four federal holidays were only enforced within the District of Columbia, providing a day off for federal workers within the district. By that point, resistance to the holiday was mild at worst, but in the mid-17th century, some of the Northeast's earliest European settlers found any celebration of the day to be criminal. We begin in Boston in 1621, the site of the first and most formal war on Christmas in the United States. Though it might seem odd today, the sharpest opposition to Christmas in our nation's history was the result of Christians themselves. Mirroring the actions of their English counterparts, Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony had no use for Christmas from the outset. Puritan resistance to Christmas began almost 100 years before with a group of Calvinist extremists in Geneva, Switzerland. Taking a strictly literal view of the scripture, Calvin and his followers had adopted the belief that any day of rest outside of Sunday was to be considered immoral and against God's law. Calvin himself had reached an agreement with the church council that as long as they would be able to return to work after the sermon, he and his followers would attend services on the four church holidays. After Calvin was exiled, a group of extremists still in Geneva were determined to take a stand, and, as the Harvard Theological Review put it in 1908, out Calvin, Calvin. In December of 1538, the group followed through, refusing to attend communion on Christmas Day and going to work instead. When they were called before the church council to explain themselves, they said that they refused because, quote, "It says in the commandment of God, 6 days shalt thou labor, whereas Christmas Day has been made a holiday," unquote. The implication being that the church, by celebrating Christmas and keeping worshipers from their work, were in fact subverting the will of God. This resistance in 1538 is the first recorded instance of anti-holiday resistance amongst the group who would become the Puritans. In time, such thinking became the law in Cromwell's England and would perhaps be most clearly defined in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The first mention of Christmas in Massachusetts can be found in William Bradford's Journal of Plymouth Plantation. where he recounts this story of newly arrived non-Puritans' actions. Quote, on the day called Christmas Day, the governor called them out to work, as was usual. But the most of this new company excused themselves and said it went against their consciences to work on that day. So the governor told them that if they made it matter of conscience, he would spare them till they were better informed. Later, he found them in the street at play openly, some pitching the bar and some at stool ball and such like sports. So he went to them and took away their implements and told them that was against his conscience, that they should play and others work. If they made the keeping of it a matter of devotion, let them keep to their houses. But there should be no gaming or reveling in the streets, since which time nothing has been attempted that way, at least openly. Unquote. In 1659, however, the war on Christmas took an even more dramatic turn, with the colony's legislature outright banning any celebration of Christmas, writing, for preventing disorders arising in several places within this jurisdiction, by reason of some still observing such festivals as were superstitiously kept in other countries, to the great dishonor of God and offense of others, it is therefore ordered by this court and the authority thereof that whosoever shall be found observing any such days as Christmas or the like, either by forbearing labor, feasting, or any other way, upon any such account as aforesaid, every such person so offending shall pay for every such offense 5 shilling as a fine to the county. Although this law, fining anyone who dared take a day off on Christmas, was repealed in 1681 upon the arrival of an increasing number of Christmas-friendly Europeans, it had a lasting impact on Massachusetts. Nearly 2 centuries later, on the threshold of the Civil War, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote for his final journal entry of the year 1856, quote, not a very merry Christmas. We are in a transition state about Christmas here in New England. The old Puritan feeling prevents it from being a cheerful, hearty holiday, though every year makes it more so, unquote. Further south, the country had already begun to embrace Christmas with a greater spirit, and in some instances, a greater number of spirits. The story of the 1826 eggnog riot, after the break. Our next story of a war on Christmas has nothing to do with people fighting about the holiday. Rather, it documents what is truly one of the strangest tales of people fighting on the holiday. Involving West Point cadets, a Scrooge-like colonel, smuggled in booze, and the future president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, this tale puts any modern Christmas table bickering to shame. 3 characters are critical to know at the outset. The first was Colonel Sylvanus Thayer. Now known as the father of West Point, he had been made superintendent of the academy in order to bring discipline to the ranks, which he enacted in part by standardizing their diet, closing the campus, and enacting a prohibition on alcohol. Initially, alcohol was still allowed on campus 2 times a year, the 4th of July and Christmas, but after a party got out of hand on Independence Day 1825, it was banned altogether, and Thayer ordered the punishment for any cadet found drinking would be arrest or expulsion. The second character of great import was Benny Havens, the owner of the closest tavern 2 miles from the campus. He developed a rapport with the cadets by allowing them to trade items for ales and seating them by the back door for quick escapes if any officer was seen approaching. A source of otherwise restricted revelry, the U.S. Army's Center of Military History described him in a 2000 journal article as being akin to the troublesome Thénardiers, the tavern keepers in Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. He would later become one of Edgar Allan Poe's only friends during his brief time at West Point. Our final prominent cast member is Jefferson Davis, who, prior to becoming president of the Confederacy, was the U.S. Secretary of War, getting his start as a cadet at West Point. Davis had begun at West Point in 1824 at 16 years old. After a relatively uneventful first year, he and his friends wandered off campus on a rainy July evening, managing to wander the full 2 miles to Benny's Tavern, where they immediately began to eat and drink. Captain Ethan Allen Hitchcock, one of their direct superiors, had noticed their absences at a formation and went straight to Benny's to track them down. Upon finding Davis and his friends visibly intoxicated, although David didn't have a drink in his hands at the time, Hitchcock confronted the young cadets. Davis tried to convince the captain that they had simply been seeking shelter from the rainstorm, but an unconvinced Hitchcock had the cadets arrested and court-martialed the following day. Responsible for mounting his own defense, Davis went on a sprawling, lie-laden testimony through which the Academy's examiners could easily poke holes. He eventually settled on arguing that his ignorance of the statute prohibiting him from visiting Benny's was enough to exonerate him of his crime. But the court-martial disagreed and he was convicted on all charges and was sentenced to be dismissed. While three of his friends who were with him at the tavern were dismissed from the Academy, Davis escaped that punishment after Colonel Thayer, at Captain Hitchcock's urging, supported the overturning of Davis's sentence, to which the Secretary of War agreed, saving Davis's career by the thinnest of margins. Colonel Thayer would come to regret this decision, writing in 1855 that Davis, now U.S. Secretary of War, had not changed from his days as a cadet and would leave, quote, a black mark, unquote, on the Army and West Point, prescient considering his later treason against the United States. This would not be the last of Davis's problems resulting from a night at Benny's. While August of 1825 had brought about his near academic demise, August of 1826 was nearly fatal. In the midst of another unsanctioned night at the tavern, an announcement was made that an officer was approaching, causing Davis and a friend to flee out the back door, running back to the academy along a cliff that bordered the Hudson. With darkness and drunkenness overpowering him, he tripped and fell nearly 60 feet down the cliffs, trees luckily breaking his fall before the rocks on the shore. He spent weeks recovering at the hospital, with doctors initially believing he would die. Mere months after he was well enough to leave the hospital, the now 18-year-old Davis again found himself engulfed in another alcohol-fueled confrontation, which nearly resulted yet again in his dismissal from West Point. The Eggnog Riot of 1826. Davis, along with at least three other cadets, planned an on-campus party in the days leading up to Christmas, with eggnog being the star of the evening. One small group of cadets rode across the Hudson, hoping their alcohol would be cheaper, and returned with 2 gallons of liquor. Davis and another cadet obtained at least 2 more gallons from Benny's, along with cinnamon and nutmeg that David convinced Benny to donate. The party started small in a single room, but as word spread and the eggnog continued to flow, the party began to spread through the barracks. By 4 a.m. on Christmas morning, the party had become so loud that it woke Captain Hitchcock, who got up to investigate. At the same time, a fully inebriated Davis had left his room to invite more cadets to the party. While he was out, however, he became aware that Hitchcock was on his way, and Davis ran back to his room to warn his fellow cadets. "Put away the grog, boys," he shouted as he entered the room. "Old Hitch is coming." It was only then that he looked up to see Old Hitch already standing inside. So face to face with the same captain who had caught him drinking 1.5 years prior and who had been a key advocate in keeping Davis on campus, one can only imagine that Davis sobered up quite quickly. Davis and the other cadets were then immediately ordered back to their rooms, an order that Davis quickly complied with, a decision that saved his place at West Point and likely every other position he would hold in his career. Davis's departure occurred right before the most dramatic events of the night. Other cadets were not as quick to comply with the order, and many began to actively resist it. "Get your dirks and bayonets and pistols if you have them," one drunken cadet shouted. "Before this night is over, Hitchcock will be dead." At least 70 cadets participated in the riot that followed. Captain Hitchcock was hit over the head with a wooden beam. Another officer was chased back to his room with a cadet's drawn sword. Windows were broken and banisters were ripped from the stairwells. Furniture and shattered dishes were scattered throughout the barracks as the cadets continued to arm themselves with anything they could get their hands on. In what was likely the night's most dramatic moment, Davis's roommate, Walter Guion, took out a pistol and attempted to shoot Hitchcock, with the captain's life being saved by another cadet bumping Guion and sending the bullet into the side of the door. While Davis avoided a court-martial due to his initial compliance with Hitchcock's order, his roommate, along with 18 other cadets, were convicted, with 12 of the 19 ultimately being expelled. In the long term, the eggnog riot even had a lasting impact on campus architecture, with new barracks built in the 1840s having short hallways that made it difficult for large numbers of cadets to quickly gather. Not all of the United States' wars on Christmas would be as harmless in the long run as a group of drunken teenage cadets. Our final example comes from the early 1920s and bears the most similarity to the clash we see today. In 1920, the wealth of Henry Ford had grown dramatically from his motor company, and following the completion of World War I, so too had his strictly isolationist beliefs. Alongside this desire for an insular United States was a vicious anti-Semitism that led him to write a long series of weekly editorials in a self-published newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. Over the course of 91 issues, stretching between 1920 and 1922, he wrote front-page editorials that were then published as a four-volume book set titled The International Jew. Full of anti-Semitic stereotypes and hate speech, it was a shameful collection of utterly vile rhetoric, including several phrases that make it pertinent to our current study. Ford's first attack appears in the second volume, writing, quote, "Last Christmas, most people had a hard time finding Christmas cards that indicated in any way that Christmas commemorated someone's birth. Now, all this begins with the designers of the cards, and even in this business, one comes upon that same policy of declaring anti-Semitic everything that is Christian." Unquote. Such phrasing of Christ's removal from Christmas greeting cards is hardly new to a purveyor of our present Christmas battles. In the third volume, Ford again raises the idea of Christmas being attacked, and that its opposition comes not from a place of religious tolerance, but of religious hatred. He writes, quote, "It is not religious tolerance in the midst of religious difference, but religious attack that they preach and practice. The whole record of the Jewish opposition to Christmas, Easter, and certain patriotic songs shows that. When Cleveland and Lakewood arranged for a community Christmas, the Cleveland Jewish Press said, 'The writer of this has no idea how many Jews there are in Lakewood, but if there is only one, there should be no community Christmas, no community religion of any kind.' That is not a council of tolerance, it is a council of attack. The Christmas literature of American Judaism is fiercer than the flames of the Inquisition." Unquote. In 1922, all of this work would be translated into German, and one Nazi leader cited it as an influence, saying at his Nuremberg trial, at which he was convicted of crimes against humanity, quote, "I read it and became anti-Semitic," unquote. Though Ford would apologize for the book in 1927 after being sued for defamation, he holds the unique dishonor of being the only American named in Hitler's manifesto, Mein Kampf. "Every year," Hitler wrote, "makes them, American Jews, more and more the controlling masters of the producers in a nation of 120 millions. Only a single great man, Ford, to their fury still maintains full independence." Today's supposed war on Christmas lacks any of the overt anti-Semitism that was rife in Ford's work, but the language and assumed consequences are notably similar. Fears of globalism and the removal of Christianity from the public square manifest themselves as perceived slights against a holiday that isn't going anywhere. At a time when anti-Semitism is again made shockingly manifest within our own country, we would be best to leave the war on Christmas behind us. After all, in this country alone, Christmas has survived outright legal bans, the idiocy of drunken cadets, and the hate and fear-filled death sentences of one of our country's most powerful men. Christmas has remarkable staying power, and this one surely won't be the last. This episode of Context Please was written, read, and produced by me, Nate Stripp. Source material for this episode can be found on our website at the link in the episode description below. For more information and visual resources on today's episode, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Context Please Pod. Finally, let us know what you think. Rate us and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. And if you liked what you heard, do us a favor and share the episode with your friends. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. Have a Merry Christmas and a wonderful holiday season. And come back soon for more Context, Please.